My name's Koen Prinsen, pastor in the church for this one. And today is the 1st of March, and we're going to start with a sermon series called Road to Easter. And it's going to go for several Sundays and Good Friday. And today, or actually this Wednesday, I believe, is the Lent is going to start. Lent is the 40 days before Easter. And it's traditionally a time of devotion, of seeking God, of preparing your hearts for Easter to really, I guess, engage again with what Jesus has done for us, his death, his resurrection, to really prepare our hearts for that. It's a time of contemplation, of seeking God. It's also a time of fasting. You know that they do carnival. Carnival is actually the sort of the last party before the fasting. Now, most people do carnival, but not the fasting. We're going to not do carnival, but we're going to do a little bit of fasting in the last week before Easter. We're going to take a week of fasting. We'll inform you about that later. But starting this Wednesday, we'll send out a daily devotional via email to you. So if you're not subscribed to our email, you can do that online on the website. There's a quick link to the newsletter. You can just sign up there. You need to do it. We can't do it for you because of AVG or GDPR and all those data rules and everything. But so you'll need to sign up for that, and you'll get a daily devotional, just a quick devotional on a passage in one of the Gospels, written by people in our church. So we'll do that together to prepare for Easter. And along with that, we're going to, in the coming Sundays, talk through the last week of the life of Jesus before the death and resurrection. And so we're starting that today in chapter 12 of the book of John. It's interesting, John spends... It's a completely different gospel than the other three gospels, the synoptic gospels. John focuses first on a period that they don't describe before, a little bit of a time before his public ministry, and then some things in his public ministry that the synoptic gospels don't cover. And then he spends the second half of his gospel mostly on the Passion Week, basically, the last week before Good Friday and before Easter. And so in the beginning, he's describing all of the miracles of Jesus, the teaching of Jesus, starting with turning water into wine, the multiplication of food, healing miracles, the resurrection of Lazarus. And John's giving attention to how Jesus speaks about himself, like I'm the bread of life, I'm the true vine, I'm this, I'm that, I'm the good shepherd. Some special conversations with Nicodemus in John 3, with the woman at the well. So you may know these stories. If you don't know, then read the Gospel of John in the coming 40 days, perhaps. But then from chapter 11 onwards, he dramatically shifts towards this last week, and you also in the story today that we're going to read, you'll see Jesus he knows that this is coming, and his heart's already sort of in Jerusalem, ready for what's coming. He knows what's going to happen, and so John is already ramping up here for Passion Week. And what he does in his gospel, he starts this off basically in chapter 11 with a report of a meeting of the religious leaders, the Sanhedrin. And this is gathering, and they are discussing the big problem that they have at this point, and that's Jesus. People believe that he's the Messiah, he is, but they don't recognize that because he's not the Messiah that they thought he would be. And so all these people are following him, and it's becoming a really big problem because he doesn't confirm their beliefs. And it's hard for them to deal with that. He doesn't fit in their little box. And so they have this really big problem, and at some point, Caiaphas, the high priest, he speaks up and suggests that they would get rid of Jesus. So they plot to kill him. And he does it with these words. Do you not realize that it's better for you that one man die for the people than that the whole nation perish? So he said, we should get rid of Jesus on behalf of all the people so that there will not be a riot and the Romans will come and destroy us all, or that he will not lead us away from the true Jewish religion, as they believed they understood. But what actually happens here is unintentionally the high priest actually prophesies what would happen, that Jesus would indeed die on behalf of all the people, that he would die so that we could have eternal life, that he would die so that our sins would be covered and taken away by his blood. He didn't know this, but he was actually prophesying that Jesus would die for this very reason. So there's a little bit of a background story to what we're going to read. the dramatic turn of events is just a week away. This is the Saturday night. It's after the Sabbath when it just finished that we're going to tune into in John chapter 12. And the thing is, what you need to keep in mind with the story, so you know this and I know this and Jesus knows this, but the people around Jesus did not know what's coming. You know, we know what would happen. We know exactly how this Passion Week is going to turn out. We know that Jesus will be arrested and killed and that he will be resurrected on the third day. But all the people in the room of the passage that we're reading, they did not know. They had no idea. And so keep that in mind when we're reading this. John chapter 12, 6 days before the Passover celebration began, Jesus arrived in Bethany, the home of Lazarus, the man he had raised from the dead. And a dinner was prepared in Jesus' honor. Martha served, of course she did. For those who know the background story of that, of course she did. And Lazarus was among those who ate with him. And then Mary took a 12-ounce jar of expensive perfume. That's about 350 milliliters. Look this up, didn't know this. Expensive perfume made from essence of nard, and she anointed Jesus' feet with it, wiping his feet with her hair, and the house was filled with the fragrance. But Judas Iscariot, the disciple who would soon betray him, said, "That perfume was worth a year's wages. It should have been sold and the money given to the poor." Not that he cared for the poor, he was a thief. And since he was in charge of the disciples' money, he often stole for himself. Jesus replied, "Leave her alone. She did this in preparation for my burial. You will always have the poor among you, but you will not always have me." When all the people heard of Jesus' arrival, they flocked to see him and also to see Lazarus, the man Jesus had raised from the dead. And then the leading priest decided to kill Lazarus too, for it was because of him that many of the people had deserted them and believed in Jesus. Okay, until there. So one of the things that I love about this story is how all these dynamics sort of come together in one place, in just this short passage of 11 verses or so. And you can really feel the tension building up. There's this beautiful act of worship of Mary to Jesus, and we'll look further into that in just a little bit. Then there's Jesus who receives that in the context of his upcoming burial. So he's feeling like, how do we say, melancholic? I don't know if I'm using the right English word for that or pronouncing it well. Then there's Judas, who shows his true face for the first time. There's the Jesus fan club outside. And there's the people that are plotting to kill him, also outside. And so all of these tensions, all of these dynamics in the whole gospel story that have been building up are sort of coming together around that house. This is happening, and it's a week before the crucifixion. And in the room is the walking miracle, Lazarus, who was raised from the dead. So we see celebration, we see threats, we see this expectation, we see internal conflict, we see hypocrisy, all of these things that are part of our daily lives as well. All of these things that we maybe have brought into this room, except I hope that no one's plotting to kill anyone. But all of these other things may be present in this room today as well. And I'm sure that Mary felt some of this. She maybe didn't understand everything, but she must have felt the tension in the room and the tension around the house of what was happening there, that there's the fan club and also the people plotting to kill Jesus. Jesus had brought her brother Lazarus back to life after being dead for 3 days. But at the same time, so she was in awe. This family, Mary and Martha and Lazarus, they were the safe place for Jesus. He would go there for you know, a bit of rest, a bit of a time of. This was a place where he was appreciated. This was a place where they understood who he was. They understood that he was the Messiah, one of the few. And there's tension building up. He knows what's coming. It's a week away. Not everyone received the one that Mary believed in as the Messiah with the same faith and hospitality. And there was a growing anxiety in Jesus' disciples as well. In chapter 11, they say, okay, let's go with him to Jerusalem. Where they are now is just around the corner from Jerusalem, basically, a couple of miles away. And they say, okay, let's go with him so that we may die with him. So they sort of, they have this idea of what's coming, of a big problem that's ahead. And they're also like, they knew that there was trouble. Let's go with him. Better that we die with him, you know, for his honor or so. But in the midst of this all, Mary does perhaps the only appropriate thing that she can think of in the midst of all the tension in the room and around the house. She does the only thing that she can think of is the most appropriate thing to do. She grabs this big jar of perfume and anoints the feet of the bringer of good news. And she worships her Messiah. So in the midst of that, those uncertain times, she decides to do the only thing she knows is right. The only thing she knows she is sure of. And that's that this Jesus is the Messiah and he deserves my worship. And so she worships him. And so what I'm going to look with you at today is five effects and five ways we can truly worship Jesus, even in the midst of uncertainty. And the first thing that stands out to me in her act of worship is that it's extravagant. Yeah. We don't really see extravagant as a good word as Christians necessarily. You know, when people are dressed extravagantly, then they're weird. Or when people behave extravagantly, then we are suspicious. But this is quite an extravagant way of worshiping Jesus. This went far beyond what you do to an honored guest. An honored guest would sit down at the best place, and one of the servants would wash his feet, and then the host of the house would take some oil and anoint the head. What Mary does is she takes the most expensive perfume in the world that they happen to have in the house, apparently, and she pours all of it out on Jesus' feet. Apparently his feet were sort of more honored for her than the head of the most honored guest she could think of. And she just pours it all out. This 12-ounce jar, 350 milliliters of very expensive perfume that she didn't get from the local Douglas store. This is probably like an heirloom, something that they had in the house maybe for generations already for a special occasion, and she decided this is that special occasion. This is the only thing I can think, the only moment I can think of. This is what this perfume is made for, sort of. This is the only appropriate way that I could spend this. It's an exceptional and over-the-top way of worshiping and of adoration. And it's beautiful. And even though the whole dinner party is organized in honor of Jesus, Mary seems to be the only person that finds the truly appropriate way to worship Jesus. She expresses her love for him. And she must have felt so weird and awkward. It must have felt so risky. But it's the biggest gesture of worship that she could think of. An extravagant way. And so in the midst of that uncertainty, when all of these dynamics were going around the room, this tension was building up, turning to Jesus for him and worshiping him in this extravagant way, maybe to her it was the most rational thing to do. even though all else is uncertain, she was sure of one thing, and that is that he is the Lord and that he deserves my worship. And so I would say to you, don't be afraid to worship him extravagantly. Don't be afraid to worship him with your hands held high, with your whole body engaged, with your whole soul and spirit and emotions engaged. Jesus will receive that as a beautiful gift of worship. Don't hold back your worship because of what others may think. Worshipping him every moment of every day and in every situation is a beautiful thing, is generous, is extravagant. So worshipping him may sometimes feel risky and unfitting, but we know that he is worthy of our praise. We know that he is worthy of our worship, and he will receive it as a beautiful gift. Right, secondly, true worship is sacrificial. The jar of perfume was worth a year's wages. Now, just think for a second for yourself, what is a year's wages for me? And if you're a student, then what is the startup pay of your perceived first job maybe in a couple years? Just have a number. All right, now think of that number. And it's fluid, and it's in a jar. And then breaking that jar and pouring all of that fluid out on the feet of Jesus. Just imagine. I mean, that's true worship. I mean, singing songs on a Sunday is beautiful. It's wonderful. And we do it, you know, with all of our heart and soul. And it inspires a life of worship. But it's only part of what true worship really is. I think any act or utterance, anything we'd say that gives honor to Jesus is worship. And sometimes we'll feel led to offer up something that's very dear to us for his glory. And Judas said it was a waste. It's quite hypocritic because in less than a week he would betray Jesus for a tenth of the amount of the value of this perfume. But Mary knew that the only appropriate way to spend this very valuable thing that they had in the house, the only appropriate way to spend it was in worship to Jesus. And so can I just ask you, how do you handle the things that are most valuable to you? Are you holding on to them, or are they surrendered to Jesus? Today we'll baptize four people. Just saw the fourth one walking in. Glad that you could make it then. And they will be surrendering today in the water the most valuable thing that they have, and that's their own lives, in surrender to Jesus. And it's a beautiful thing that we can celebrate together today. They're laying down their lives literally at the feet of Jesus. Thirdly, true worship is humble. Mary dries off the feet of Jesus with her hair. Now that's weird. Let me just, that is a bit odd. Like, even if Anya would do this to me, I would feel super awkward. And we're quite close. Like, that's, yeah, you'd feel awkward as well, probably. You feel awkward now, me mentioning this. So I'd feel super uncomfortable and awkward, but maybe it's a cultural thing. I don't know if this was normal in that time. But Paul would later refer to a woman's hair as her glory, and so I think we can interpret it in this way, that she is really laying down her glory at the feet of Jesus. Maybe that's how we can read that, that she is humbling herself, that she is laying down her glory at his at his feet. And true worship is always humbling in the sense that in worship we acknowledge that it's not about us, that it's about him. It's about the one that we worship. We acknowledge that to him belongs all the power and all the honor and all the glory forever and ever. And if it belongs to him, then we can't hold on to that for much longer. And I think sometimes worship and prayer are therefore best done on our knees, just to that our posture follows after what we're saying, that we're surrendering to him. And it takes some training to be comfortable praying on your knees. And actually, maybe it's not even meant to be comfortable. But it's this beautiful way of surrendering. I mean, consider your posture when you worship. And think about what it means about your intentionality in the prayer, about your faith, about your surrender to Him, about your devotion. Let's make a habit of praying on our knees, of worshiping on our knees. Yes. And be excited. Fourthly, true worship is Jesus-centered. So Mary's act of worship was only for Jesus, just solely for Him. It's like she doesn't even have eyes for anyone else in the room. All eyes are on Jesus and on what she's doing. It wasn't about how she felt. It wasn't about what the others thought about Jesus or what was going on outside. It wasn't even about the value of that perfume that she poured out on His feet. It was just about Him. It was about Jesus. True worship is focused on Him, on the one that we worship. I also love how Jesus responds to Judas. He could have said, like what He did with Peter. Peter said a couple of days later, like, I will follow you, I'll stand by you, whatever happens. And He says, well, you'll deny me three times before the rooster crows. So He could have said something similar to Judas here, like, well, you with your big mouth, but in just a week's time, you'll betray me for 10% of the amount of money that you're complaining about. But He didn't. Jesus responds to Judas' hypocrisy with, you will always have the poor with you, but you will not always have me. But Jesus, we might ask, how could I take valuable time, valuable money to worship you while there are so many things going on that I need to worry about, that I need to do something about, people that need me, people that need my time and my effort and my care, and there are so many things to be done. But I believe Jesus just took this moment with Judas as a teaching moment, maybe also for us. Like, I know that there's very important things to do. Right? Jesus was, all for the poor and helping them, and still is, and still assigning us to think of others and not just ourselves, to love our neighbor as ourself. But it's like He's saying, there'll always be important things to do. This work will never stop. There will always be things to worry about, to do something about, to think of, but you have to know when it's time to stop and just rest at my feet and be with me. You have to know when to stop and just be with Jesus. So through worshiping Jesus, we keep Him front and center in everything that we do, understanding that ultimately it is all about Him. And from that place, anything that we then do, that worrying about the poor and helping other people and serving other people, we can do with this heart of worship, with this heart that is devoted to Him, and it will not become a thing in itself, and it will not become a way to sort of be good enough for Him or to feel better about ourselves, but it will come from this place of worship. It has to come from the place of worship. Lastly, true worship affects the whole room. I love how it says that the house was filled with the fragrance. Now, I don't know why John put this in the sentence. I believe it's intentionally. Maybe he just remembered the smell and it took him back to the room. He could see Mary do that. And the smell sort of takes him back. It must have been a once-in-a-lifetime type of smell because, it was such a special perfume. Maybe he could still feel his heart beating when Judas so rudely interrupted that beautiful moment. And maybe he could still feel the tension of that week and the build-up and everything. Maybe that's why he put it in. Maybe he put it in to remind us that when we worship Jesus, it's not only affecting us. First of all, it affects Jesus. Jesus makes it very personal. He's not just saying, yes, this is worship for me. I am the Messiah. You should worship me in this way. No, he's saying, he's thinking very in a very personal way. Like, don't stop her. She's doing this to prepare me for my burial. So he takes it in a personal and in an emotional way. And that's a beautiful thing. And that's, Jesus is personally affected by your worship. It means something to him. It's not just, yes, creature, worship. It's this personal thing. Yes, my loved one, like, I love you too. This is a relationship. You're doing a beautiful thing, and I receive it. It encourages me. It does something to me. It affects me. It's not just the appropriate thing to do. It's a personal act of worship to him. And secondly, in the way that a smell of a perfume fills a room, so our worship affects any room that we're in. See, when we worship, something changes in the atmosphere. You can't see it or touch it, but you can sort of smell it. You can kind of receive it with a different sense. And so I want to encourage you, let your worship for Jesus fill every room that you set foot into. Your living room, your dinner table, your bedroom, your office, the bus, any room that you step in, the elevator, any room that you step into, let's fill that with worship. Let's fill that with the aroma of the glory of God, because we're carrying it with us. When you get into the supermarket, when you get into, I don't know where you're going to be, the coffee store, let's fill that with worship. Let's fill this world with worship, pointing every eye to Jesus.